Hi, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson. Welcome to Interpreter Insights. Our topic tonight is going to be the Psalms, and my guest is going to be David J. Larson. Now, the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and even scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. If you like the podcast, please tell your friends about it and subscribe. You can give us a rating. You can subscribe anywhere you get a podcast app. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. But I have really been excited to have David on with us, and so I'm going to welcome David to the program. David, this is a real pleasure for me. We've not officially met. I think I've seen you at a conference or two here or there over the years, but nothing formal. But I've been really excited to have you on the Interpreter Insights program, primarily because you are a longtime contributor to Interpreter. In fact, for those who aren't familiar, David is one of the co-authors of the first book published by the Interpreter Foundation, clear back in 2013. David, tell us a little bit about that book.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a great pleasure to be speaking with you. That book, co-authored with Jeffrey Bradshaw, was In God's Image and Likeness 2. It was his second volume. He had written a treatment of, you know, starting off with the Pearl of Great Price, the Book of Moses. And I thought it was an incredible book. And so I was really pleased when he asked me to help him with the second volume that looked at the stories of Noah and Enoch. He reached out to me because I had been studying under Andre Orlov at Marquette University, and Dr. Orlov is well recognized for his work on the Enoch material, particularly 2 Enoch. But I had a great interest in Enoch and had done some study on that. And so he reached out to me to help specifically with some of the material in his volume on Enoch. And that was a lot of fun to work with Jeff. He is amazing and prolific. And my addition to that work was quite minimal, but it was a lot of fun to work with him on that.
So this came at a period of time when I was introduced to you through a means we'll talk about in a minute. But just tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, what got you interested in this field, and then how you went about it, because you were one of the Nibley scholars. So tell us a little about that program and your experience eventually leading you to St. Andrews.
So I guess we could start with my studies at BYU. My undergraduate degree was in Near Eastern Studies, and they've now kind of split that degree into different degrees. I believe there's an ancient Near Eastern Studies. At the time, it was just kind of one broad program where you could study about the Hebrew Bible, or you could study modern Middle East politics, and I got a bit of all of that. I'd chosen to go into that because when I was younger, about 15 years old, I had the opportunity to go with my bishop, who worked for the church educational system, on a tour of Israel. And I fell in love with the country, with this history. And we visited so many sites of religious interest that that really kind of sunk in. And so when I went to BYU, I chose Near Eastern Studies. And really that started my journey. After I graduated, you know, I was married and had a child, and I felt like I needed to, you know, go to work for a while. So I had a job with the federal government for 4 or 5 years and decided that what I was really passionate about was studying religion. So at that point, I went back to school. I went to graduate school at Marquette University. And I chose Marquette because I had become really interested in studying apocryphal and pseudepigraphal texts, you know, texts that we find that were written often in the intertestamental periods between the Old and New Testaments. And there's a lot of apocalyptic literature that I found very interesting. And there is a professor at Marquette University Andrei Orlov, who specializes in that material. And so that's really why I chose the program at Marquette. He and other professors there really, you know, helped my interest in that type of literature grow. And that's, you know, so that's when I started looking more at the Enoch material and other texts like the Apocalypse of Abraham. And I really got into texts that described figures that would ascend up into heaven and have kind of a tour of heaven or heavenly journey, have mysteries revealed to them in the heavenly realm. And so that's really kind of what got me into these topics.
You got a grant from, I think it was from the Maxwell Institute or Farms in order to do this, right?
That's right.
Or did that come later?
Well, that didn't come right at the beginning. I think I had been in the program for a while when I reached out to BYU, it was the Maxwell Institute at that point, and applied for these grants. First there was the Nibley Fellowship, and then I also received dissertation grants from the Maxwell Institute when I went on and started my PhD at the University of St. Andrews. So it was a number of years that I was receiving those fellowships and grants, and I'm extremely grateful to the Maxwell Institute for that. It really helped me on my academic journey.
Were there any stipulations about subjects or about, you know, kind of areas of study? Because tell us what your master's thesis was, and then when you went to St. Andrews, it changed a little bit, did it not?
That's right. Yeah. So I don't recall there being any specific stipulations about subject matter. I did have to apply, and I had to explain what I was studying and what my desired academic goals were, and that type of thing. And so my application was judged on those bases. But when I was at Marquette studying a variety of different apocalyptic texts, and I ended up by the end of my time there, when I was writing my final paper, they actually didn't have us write a thesis. It was kind of an exam and a final kind of a capstone paper. But I was focused on Melchizedek traditions and kind of how that connected to Jesus and the Epistle to the Hebrews and that type of thing, and traditions outside of the Bible regarding Melchizedek. So that's kind of what I was focusing on towards the end of my master's degree. But at that time, I was reading a lot about connections between these apocalyptic texts and biblical texts in the prophets and also in the Psalms. And I began reading more about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so when I went on to St. Andrews, my focus was on how the Psalms were being interpreted in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Kind of with my dissertation, didn't really go into this, but kind of in the back of my mind, how the Psalms were playing into this larger world of the apocalyptic texts and their visions of heaven and the heavenly priesthood and kind of, you know, temple connections that I could find between the Psalms and what was going on in some of these texts that were found at Qumran.
And so eventually you, about this time, and I can't remember, but this is where I intersected with you in a very distant way, of course. And I've been deeply affected in my personal study by Kevin Christensen, whose work introduced me to Margaret Barker, you, who introduced me to Andrei Orlov and Crispin Fletcher Lewis, and of course, Jeff, who I reviewed his first volume, said, "This is a book I wish I'd written." All three of those. But you had this blog, and I remember it was called Heavenly Ascents, and I couldn't wait for new entries. I may have been maybe the only person out there who was following it, and I never commented. I mean, I'm not a big blogger knackle person. I don't comment a lot on these kind of things, but I track it. And I remember, who's this Andrei Orlov guy? And you had mentioned him and his work on Melchizedek, and I got his book on the heavenly priesthood traditions, Heavenly Priesthood and the Apocalypse of Abraham. His work is very good up to a point, especially when he talks about the heavenly mirror, he kind of loses me. But he's very good on those things, and I understand he's working on a Hermeneia volume for Second Enoch. And I've got the Charlesworth volumes on First Enoch, And we've interviewed Vanderkam on Interpreter, but we have not had the chance to get Orloff yet.
At one point, we almost had him come and speak at BYU, I don't know, 15 years ago or so, and some complications came up and he didn't end up coming out. He knows that the LDS community, or a lot of us in the LDS community, have interest in the topics that he writes on, and he appreciates that. That brings back a lot of good memories. When I started my master's degree, the Bloggernacle was a big thing. That was kind of the early 2000s. I started my master's degree in 2006, and there were so many good blogs out there that I was getting into that I thought, wow, I want to jump on board and share some of the things that I'm learning in my master's degree and in the readings that I'm doing in many of my classes, and especially Dr. Orlov's. I was constantly being fed this amazing information. I felt like I was just, you know, tapping into this fountain of amazing material that I was learning so much from and was really enriching my own understanding. And I just wanted to share that on the blog as much as I can. You know, at that point, I started going to academic conferences like the Society of Biblical Literature's annual conference, and was learning so much from those as well that I would try to relay that on my blog. I'm so indebted to Dr. Orlov and to my other great professors there. They have a really interesting forum there called the Roots of, it's going back a long time
Roots
now.
Roots of Eastern Mysticism, I think.
The Roots of the Jewish Roots of Eastern Christian Mysticism.
Mysticism, yes.
Yeah, if I can say it. And that was a wonderful forum that they had there that, you know, they would have speakers come in from all over that were kind of into apocalyptic texts and Jewish mysticism and Christian mysticism. And they would have graduate students presenting their papers and scholars from around the world that would come and speak there. And that was just an incredible experience for me.
So let's clarify for the audience that when we use the term mysticism, we're not talking about something that's made up. It's really more of things that people do in order to get into the presence of God. Would that be a simple way to say that?
Yes. You know, yeah, I would agree with that statement. There are different ways that people look at it. Some people look at it as kind of a purely literary phenomenon, that the subject matter that is being discussed, kind of the esoteric or heavenly secrets type of material, plays into mysticism. But there's also definitely an element, and a lot of scholars would look at it as reports of actual visionary experiences that these authors have had. At least that's the take that some scholars have on it, where they're describing what they are doing, you know, different rituals or the repetition of certain words or phrases or things that bring them into this mystical visionary experience, where they're often having some kind of contact with God or some kind of vision of the heavenly realms that they then describe. And
that was the title of your blog. It was called Heavenly Ascents.
That's right. Yeah, Heavenly Ascents. That was just such a fascinating topic to me that that's what I felt I should name my blog. And I focused on a variety of things, you know, within that kind of apocalyptic, mystical genre. But the ascent to heaven tradition was kind of what most interested me at the time.
Eventually, you finished your doctoral thesis. What's the title of that?
My doctoral thesis was entitled The Royal Psalms in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So pretty straightforward title. Those who aren't familiar with what a royal psalm is, as scholars have gone through and kind of categorized different types of psalms, whether they be psalms of praise or community psalms, or there's a wide variety of different psalms. One of the categories that scholars kind of put together, and not based on the style or the structure necessarily of the psalm, but psalms that featured kingship. that talked about the king or talked about the office of kingship, what a king might do, or speaking of King David and events in his life, that type of thing. Those were named royal psalms. And there's different enumerations of the royal psalms, but generally scholars put 11 of the psalms in that category of royal psalm.
Does that include the 110, the one with Melchizedek?
It does. Yes, yes. That is one of the main ones, the most widely recognized of the royal psalms. You know, one that gets used in a lot of Jewish literature and then is especially popular among the New Testament authors as well. But I mean, just to go through them real quickly, the royal psalms that are generally recognized are Psalm 2, Psalm 18, Psalm 21 and 22, Psalm 45, Psalm 72, Psalm 101, 110, 132, and also 144. So if you know, if the audience has an opportunity to look,
if you're keeping score out there,
right. If you want to look up those psalms, you'll see, you know, why they're designated as royal.
What's the application in the Dead Sea Scrolls? I mean, were all of the psalms in the Dead Sea Scrolls?
No. The psalms seem to be very popular to the community that was gathering those scrolls and ended up hiding them away in the caves at Qumran near the Dead Sea. They're generally considered to be 34 or 36 different scrolls that were found that have psalms on them. However, none of them have all of the 150 psalms that we have in our book of psalms in our Old Testament. A lot of the scrolls are kind of pieces of scrolls, and so they had, you know, just a few psalms on them. There is one scroll that's called the Great Psalm Scroll that has many of the psalms that we have in our book of psalms, but not all of them. It also includes some psalms that we don't have in our book of psalms.
That was going to be my follow-up question.
Yeah, so there's some psalms that were found there that are in the Septuagint, you know, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, that we would call Psalm 151, 152, some of those. But there's also psalms there that we don't find anywhere else. They're not in the Septuagint, and they're either, you know, some of the psalms have been kind of reconfigured into kind of a different psalm, and there's some text that we just don't find elsewhere.
Are any of those royal psalms?
Well, that's kind of a case that I try to make in my dissertation, that some of those other texts take the royal psalms as kind of a pattern to, you know, to inspire their writings. And so they turn out kind of similar to what we find in the royal psalms in our Bible. So they are very interesting. And not only in scrolls that we would call psalm scrolls, there's also other poetic texts. There's a large body of texts that we call the Thanksgiving Psalms or Thanksgiving Hymns that are absolutely not found in our Bible or anywhere else. And a lot of those Thanksgiving Psalms seem to draw inspiration from the royal psalms.
So you've done your dissertation, and now you're preparing it for publication with a publisher. What's the process for that? In a lot of the books that I see, people say, yeah, this was my dissertation, and now I'm being published, whether it's from Brill or Peters or De Gruyter or any one of a number of Eisenbrons, any one of a number who does this. What's the process of transferring it from a thesis to a book?
That's a really good question, and I think it's a bit different for everyone, but generally a dissertation has quite a narrow focus, and oftentimes, and this was true in my case, the dissertation is very analytical in nature. You're taking a problem and you're proposing a solution to that problem. You're looking at texts and you're analyzing them very carefully, and dissertations can be very technical in nature. And so a lot of times when you're looking to publish this, unless you're publishing it in kind of a, a series of published dissertations, if you're perhaps looking for a wider audience with your publication, then the publisher is often going to want you to expand it or embellish it or cater it to a broader audience that maybe is not going to be so familiar with the technical jargon and is maybe would maybe be interested in something that doesn't have quite a narrow academic focus. So that element is definitely still there. But, you know, when you're doing a dissertation, you drill down so particularly on your topic of interest, on the specific problem that you're trying to solve, that there aren't many people, even scholars, that would be terribly interested in what you have to say about that very narrow topic. And so even writing for or trying to get published with an academic journal, you're going to want to expand a little bit on that, or, you know, refine your central argument or include additional material that would be of interest to a bit wider audience.
So in your interpreter contributions, it's pretty obvious that you've taken the Psalms and done some things with it. And we'll get to that in a second. But I guess when you're doing a dissertation, it's not specifically aimed at LDS topics. So if you want to cover temple themes in the Royal Psalms or the Dead Sea Scrolls or something, you have to aim it towards a more generalized scholarly audience, correct?
That's correct. Generally speaking, you know, of course, I've read some wonderful dissertations that were specifically on the way the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or Joseph Smith or, you know, have looked at a particular topic, or there are schools out there that have Mormon studies or Latter-day Saints studies programs, and there are wonderful dissertations that are written for those programs.
But not an application like what you did. So right. I notice in some of your interpreter work at the temple seminars, you've done a couple, and I'd like to go over those with you if we could. So in 2021... they did a reprint from the presentation you gave in 2012 at the Matthew Brown Conference, and it was called From Dust to Exalted Crown, Royal and Temple Themes Common to the Psalms and the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it seems to me that in this presentation, you're building on your dissertation, but from a Latter-day Saint perspective and a temple perspective. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
And understanding this is like 15 years ago, so we understand that the fog of memory may interfere a little. I encourage the listeners, just go to the journal, go to the author index, and look up David's contributions, and they're all outlined right there. Four of them are with Jeff Bradshaw. They're really long, and they're the things that we covered earlier in our presentation about the Apocalypse of Abraham, the Book of Moses, Enoch, some of the things that he learned there. But these two on the Psalms, there's this one and there's another one that really caught my attention. Go ahead, David.
So thank you. Yes, writing and researching and presenting those papers was really a joy for me, because you're correct, as you were saying previously, when you do a dissertation, you are writing on a topic and in a way that you want your dissertation to be approved by scholars and the team that's evaluating your dissertation. And so sometimes you can't go into all the topics that you're interested in, or perhaps topics that would be, related to your own personal beliefs. And so it was wonderful to present at these Matthew Brown, Mount Zion conferences, because they allowed me to take some of the things that I had studied for my PhD and then kind of apply them to topics that I was interested in that are related to the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. And one of the things that had really enchanted me when I was looking at the apocalyptic texts, and then, you know, that kind of fed into my study of the Psalms as well, is how these texts were related to the temple And there were connections to Solomon's temple, to ancient temple ritual. There are many that believe that the Psalms were very closely connected to the worship that was conducted in the ancient temple, and also the apocalyptic texts, that they kind of stemmed out of temple traditions. Even after the temple was destroyed, some of the understanding and the beliefs and perhaps even the rituals were put down in these narratives, in these apocalyptic texts. So when I wrote these papers for these conferences, these Matthew Brown Temple on Mount Zion conferences, I used my study of the Psalms and tried to connect them into, you know, what we could understand of the ancient temple, and try to present them in a way that would be recognizable or relatable to a Latter-day Saint audience, that perhaps would enhance our understanding of our temple ritual and temple theology today.
When I look at this and I read some of the references, I can see it clearly what you put together. All the Glory of Adam by Crispin Fletcher Lewis, which takes some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then he talks about humans becoming divine through the means of the temple, that kind of thing. And just summarizing, there are six principles, I guess, that you came up with. And as I looked through this article, you rattled off the Royal Psalms. Now, I'd imagine after spending so many years, that comes second nature to you, but you did it again in this article at the beginning. And then there are six, and I'm not going to embarrass you by asking you to name the six right now, but these are the six for our audience. An individual, likely the teacher of the community or congregation, is delivered by God and lifted up to stand in the divine council. In the heavenly setting, the exalted man is taught the mysteries of wonder, which include the story of God's primeval victories and his creation of the world. This instruction is apparently given by God himself, and some texts state the individual has gazed upon God or God's glory, or that God has appeared to him. Then we have the individual is appointed to teach the mysteries to his community or congregation. Those who receive his teachings are likewise elevated to heaven and participate in the heavenly vision and praise God with the angelic beings. And when the group, probably both mortals and angels, witnesses the revelation of the wonderful deeds of God in the creation, they shout or sing for joy and engage in praising God, and they are clothed in heavenly robes of righteousness. The vast majority of our listeners are going to picture in their mind things that relate from our experiences in our version of the temple. And this is the kind of thing that has always interested me in this subject. How close do we make these connections, or is this about as far as we really need to go, as long as we have a general picture?
That is a really good evaluation and great question.
Well, that's because I was quoting you directly, okay? Those were your words, word for word.
Well, thank you. And just to give a little bit of a background to where I came up with those points, they're kind of pulled together from my study specifically of the Thanksgiving hymns primarily, and some other texts found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, where the authors of those texts appear to be drawing on some of these royal psalms. And really, you know, in particular, Psalm 18 and Psalm 89, and they're drawing on inspiration from what they're getting, you know, what they're seeing in these psalms, and they're expressing it in this manner. And this is kind of found across numerous of these different texts, these Thanksgiving hymns. But when you analyze them as a body, you can kind of pull out these recurring themes of, you know, someone ascending to heaven, being taught the heavenly mysteries, and then being assigned to teach those mysteries to their own followers on earth. The followers on earth, when they're taught the mysteries, they can participate in this same kind of heavenly ascent or heavenly experience. And, you know, there's a lot of details that come into it. And, you know, sometimes, you know, they're clothed in heavenly robes and, you know, different experiences. You know, they learn the language or the songs of the angels, and they praise God with the angels in heaven. There's some different details that come into it in some of the different texts. But I saw this pattern throughout a lot of these texts that I was studying. And you can see them in apocalyptic texts as well. There's a text called the Testament of Levi, you know, where Levi is taken up into heaven and he's washed and anointed and clothed. And
he holds the incense in his cupped hands and the whole bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so many details that really we can recognize or we can relate to as Latter-day Saints. And there's always a danger of, you know, what people term as parallelomania, where you start seeing things and they look, you know, they look familiar and you start trying to fit them into a box. But I really think in so many of these texts that I've studied, it comes up so often. And there is, you know, and a lot of scholars would say there is connection with the ancient temple that these texts are kind of drawing on traditions or memories of the temple, that I think it's just kind of second nature for us to look at our temple experience. And Joseph Smith claimed that the principles or different aspects of the temple are of ancient origin and were revealed from the beginning. And so when we look at that and then we see all these texts with, you know, temple-like material in them, I think it's natural for us to take those and try to understand our temple experience by looking at some of those texts.
The other article that you did was about pilgrimages. It was more of a heavenly ascent. So that one focused more on the ascent, whereas the second one did something else. And have you gotten a third paper out of that yet, or have we kind of gone past that?
No, and you know, maybe this is kind of lack of originality on my point, but I've kind of taken that pattern, you know, that I found in my dissertation work, and I've tried to look at the Psalms and the temple from a number of different perspectives, but kind of seeing how that pattern can be seen from other directions and that. And so I have written some other papers, not just those couple that were published with Interpreter, but I published a paper, and actually kind of the first of that series where I really kind of first elucidated that pattern in a paper for a journal that actually doesn't exist anymore with the Maxwell Institute. It's called The Bible and Antiquity. I think is what it was called.
I'll have to look for that.
Yeah.
I think it'd be in the Scholar's Archives, wouldn't it?
Right, right. I believe so. And that paper was entitled Angels Among Us, How the Psalms Passages with Temple Themes Influenced the Authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, something of that nature. I should remember the title. But that's kind of where I first looked at it. And I've published other papers since then using elements of that as well. The one that you mentioned about the pilgrimages was an interesting idea that I got from a couple of different scholars that talked about how Israelites would have seen their pilgrimage, their ascension up to the temple, because, of course, Jerusalem and then the temple was on
a hill.
Yeah, exactly. And so their pilgrimage up to the temple was likely seen as a journey up into heaven, as the temple was supposed to represent heaven for them. We can look at those pilgrimages that they would have undertaken at the different festival seasons for the Israelites, for the Jews, as an ascension to heaven. And so that paper kind of went into that idea.
It's called Ascending into the Hill of the Lord, What the Psalms Can Tell Us About the Rituals of the First Temple. Came out in 2020. Now, it was put on the website, I think, and reprinted in 2020, but it was originally part of the first Matthew Brown Conference from 2011. So it's in the first volume of the books that Interpreter has. And if you go on the website, for those of you, you can find it. I know I sound like I'm a constant commercial, but one of the goals of this particular podcast is to help people understand the treasures of what has been published over the last 15 years. Well, we're coming up on 15. Now, you've carried on your work with the Psalms again for an Interpreter conference. Just in the end of May, we had the Small Plates Conference, and you presented there a paper called The Things Which Were Written According to David, The Theology of the Small Plates Through the Lens of Their Intertextual Use of the Psalms. I just want to take a couple of minutes here at the tail end of our visit and just have you tell us a little about that paper, what you used, and I'm sure there will probably be some other interpreter folks who talk to you more in detail about that presentation, and we'll look forward to it in the volumes of the proceedings when they come out
Absolutely. Well, as this conference was specifically on the small plates, I decided to take the studies that I've done on the Psalms and present on the Psalms, how they're used in the Book of Mormon. And this is actually a topic that I got to study and write about for a number of years when I worked for Book of Mormon Central, which is now Scripture Central. Worked for them for a few years and really had the opportunity to see where the Psalms or phrases from the Psalms show up in the Book of Mormon and how they're being used, how the Book of Mormon authors kind of weave in lines from the Psalms into their texts. They don't say that they're quoting from the Psalms, but there are key phrases from a variety of different Psalms. I found about 60 different Psalms that lines from them are used in the Book of Mormon, throughout the Book of Mormon. But as this conference focused on the small plates, I wanted to elucidate some examples from Nephi and Jacob on how they brought up these lines from the Psalms and how the use of the Psalms kind of enriched the text that where they were used by Nephi and Jacob. I did want to mention that there's an evangelical pastor that has a lot of interaction with Latter-day Saints. I haven't met him personally. His name's Kyle Beshears. He seems to be a really great guy and has a lot of genuine and sincere interactions with Latter-day Saints and has written a lot on
LDS. Yeah, he has a recent book that was not quite as impressive, we'll just say that.
I actually haven't read it myself. I've seen some reviews. When Kyle Beshears did his master's degree, he did his thesis on the Book of Mormon, and he brought up the fact that King David is rarely mentioned in the Book of Mormon. When Jacob mentions him, it's a negative reference. Like, we don't want to be like David and Solomon, right? And their polygamy. And he kind of criticizes the Book of Mormon for not having Psalms and not talking more about David. You know, if these were Jews that were looking forward to a Messiah, why don't they talk about David? And so my paper looks at, it's not really a response to Beshear's thesis, but I kind of, you know, take that as a launching point to really show that the Book of Mormon does use the Psalms quite frequently. And Nephi and Jacob really ingeniously weave Psalms into some of their stories. A lot of times we don't even notice it. For example, I talk about how Nephi's story of his father's dream of the tree of life, and then his own vision of his father's dream use lines from the Psalms, and it really kind of enriches and moves the story along. In fact, the iron rod, one of the only places where a rod of iron is mentioned in the Bible is, I mean, it's mentioned in the Book of Revelation as well, but the primary mention is in Psalm 2, where it's talking about the king or the Messiah will rule with a rod of iron. And so I kind of talk about how Nephi may be using Psalm 2 in the way that he structures the written version of his vision and his account of his father's vision. And many other Psalms are in there as well. And so kind of counter the idea that the Psalms aren't in the Book of Mormon. And I also give reasons for why David isn't mentioned much. And when he is, he's mentioned kind of negatively. Nephi and Jacob and others were looking to Moses more as the ideal for leadership, for kingship, as stipulated in Deuteronomy chapter 17, the ideal for what a king should be. And they apparently didn't see David and Solomon as great examples, at least in the end, of what a king should be.
It is interesting to see that the Book of Mormon clearly does not really like kings. I mean, obviously, if you can have a righteous king, that's preferable. But as a general rule, they don't want them, and it's usually led them poorly, just as it did for Israel. So
yeah,
I think that's something that there's open to interpretations on both sides.
And without drilling down too much on that topic, yeah, there are a lot of LDS scholars that have written on that. I use the work of Noel Reynolds and Taylor Halverson in my paper. And I think the story of the Deuteronomist is a really complex one. And I think we still have a lot of work to do on really understanding understanding how the Deuteronomistic history was put together and how that relates to the book of Deuteronomy and what Lehi and his family's relationship was to the Deuteronomists and that kind of school of thought. There are some that believe that the Deuteronomists kind of came down from the northern kingdom and that maybe Lehi and his family would have been on board with some of their thinking. But as the Deuteronomists came down and were integrated and became influential in the kingdom of Judah and the royal dynasty of Judah, it seems that maybe some of their ideas kind of morphed as they kind of integrated themselves and wanted to maybe ingratiate themselves into the royal circles in Judah. And again, this is really complex, and I can't say that I fully understand it by any means. But it's possible that the Deuteronomists and the Deuteronomic history maybe became something that Lehi maybe would not have agreed with eventually. It's hard to say.
Well, the thing that I get is the visionary, their attack on the visionary. And yes, that was Laman and Lemuel's biggest thing against Lehi. Our father's a visionary man. For me, that's a red flag. I like this that you've just said about, well, maybe it's a lot more nuanced than we think, because that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I've been doing a lot of reading lately about various schisms in Judaism about the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls and about the time of the fall of the temple, Herod's temple, not Solomon's. There's a scholar named Paul Hager. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He's a Holocaust survivor, and he got his PhD when he was 60 in the early 90s. And then he wrote 7 books before he died at the age of 94. And he's attempted to show how there were a lot more variations in Judaism at that time than we really realize, and maybe what was behind those to the degree that we can figure it out.
You know, I'm kind of learning as I go along with this as well. And just kind of a last note on that, you are correct that Jesus did love the book of Deuteronomy. The New Testament uses Deuteronomy a lot, as well as the Psalms and Isaiah. And it seems like the early Book of Mormon authors especially were interested in at least maybe not the whole Deuteronomic history, but the Book of Deuteronomy. And Nephi as a leader and then subsequent kings, as you mentioned, Benjamin and Mosiah, they seem to want to pattern themselves on this model of kingship, this ideal of what kingship should be that we find in Deuteronomy chapter 17. You know, I definitely wouldn't eschew. I do have a lot of sympathy and understand where Margaret Barker is coming from and Kevin Christensen's work on her ideas about the Deuteronomic reforms of King Josiah. I think there are important insights to gain from that, but I don't think we need to totally exclude the book of Deuteronomy and the early Lehites' obvious interest in that book.
David, it's been a real pleasure to be with you. Thank you for being with us. It's been terrific to have this visit with you, and I hope to do it again sometime. And I hope everybody follows your work, and good luck on your professional endeavors going forward. And thank you for your many years of scholarship that's really benefited me, and I'm sure the other listeners.
Well, thanks, Terry. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate you reaching out to me. And it was real pleasure to talk to you about this. I love your interest in these topics, and would love to talk to you anytime.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. This is Terry Hutchinson for David Larson and Interpreter Insights. Please join us again.